American politics may never be the same. On To The Point, we help you understand the trends driving this wild and woolly election.
Usually we don't have a presidential election in which the sanity of a major party candidate is really openly in question.
She's not the greatest politician. She says so herself.
She colors within the lines of American politics.
Does the Democratic Party need a reform? Absolutely.
I'm Armin Alney. Stay with To The Point through November and beyond on KCRW and KCRW.com.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's go!
The next debate is on Sunday. Has Donald Trump been studying? CNN's instant poll showed Mike Pence won the vice presidential debate, but he did it by basically pretending his running mate was Mitt Romney. And leaked pages of Donald Trump's taxes show he claimed a loss of $916 million in 1995. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Gene Sperling, who directed the National Economic Council under Presidents Clinton and Obama. He's also been advising Hillary Clinton. Our special guest is Juliette Kayyem, former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security and host of the podcast Security Mom. Welcome, everybody. So, Rich, you wrote a very counterintuitive column this week, arguing that this year is the year of the normal Republican. And you used Mike Pence's performance at Tuesday's debate as Exhibit A. Sketch out that case for us. How can the year that Donald Trump executed a hostile takeover of the Republican Party be the year of the normal Republican?
Well, it's the year of the normal Republican in the sense that it was the year of the woman in 1992, where a woman wasn't elected president, but you had a lot of women Senate candidates winning their races. And it's just notable, almost in every single, there are a couple exceptions, but almost every single contested Senate race in a battleground state, the Republicans senatorial candidate is running well ahead of Donald Trump. In the averages in New Hampshire, for instance, Kelly Ayotte is running 10 points ahead of Donald Trump. And that is completely unheard of. Usually, you know, you might run a point or two ahead or behind the candidate. And this is a sign to me that it wants to be a change election and a Republican year, but it very likely won't be at the top of the ticket because Republicans didn't manage actually to nominate a normal Republican.
It's funny. This is interesting in that, you know, I think Rich is right that Senate candidates will run ahead of Donald Trump, partly because Donald Trump is going to run quite badly, it increasingly looks like. But what Rich is starting to lay out is the fervent wish and hope of a lot of people in the Republican Party and in the conservative movement, which is that basically after this election is over, we can all sort of pretend it never happened and go back to what we were doing before. And I think that is a significant part of what Mike Pence was up to on Tuesday. I know, Gene, you were tweeting about that. Do you think that this was a win for Republican normalcy on Tuesday?
Well, I thought it was one of the more unusual debates in the following way, which is, as I think's been noted, you had a Republican VP look like maybe he tied or slightly won with virtually all of the complimentary actions, comments made about him being the degree that he did not defend the top of the ticket. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of the Gore-Bush debate, where Gore kind of slightly won one of the debates in 2000. But because the Bush campaign very skillfully exploited his size and his nonverbal communication, over a few days, people tended to think that Bush had actually won that debate. And I think that's exactly what's happening here. I think that, you know, Pence looked to, you know, perform maybe a tiny bit better stylistically and got maybe that slight win. But then over and over again afterwards, the story is that even the vice presidential candidate won't stand by the top of the ticket and, in fact, is being complimented for the degree he didn't stand by the top of the ticket. And it was very easy for the Hillary Clinton campaign to show that he repeatedly refused to acknowledge things that Donald Trump had actually said and gave a description of the position of Russia or Putin that seemed almost the opposite of what Trump said. So I think this is one of those ones where you know, 2 hours after the debate, slight win for Pence. But 3 days after the debate, this looks like it was a win for Kaine and for Hillary Clinton.
Julia, what did you think of that? I my jaw basically dropped during those Russia answers, talking about how we need a confrontational stance toward Vladimir Putin. We need a president who will stand up to him, almost as though Mike Pence were unaware that his running mate was Donald Trump, who's, you know, set aside all the links and the, you know, the praise language, and he says nice things about me, I'll say nice things about him. It's been his explicit policy position that we should try to have a softening, a more conciliatory approach with Russia.
Yeah, it did make me think, just because Pence is, surely has to know that that the Clinton campaign was going to be making a video out of all of this, that he may have actually not known a lot of the policy positions of Trump, or at some stage stopped paying attention. And that may go to sort of a big disconnect between the two campaigns, the vice presidential and the presidential in this regard. But, you know, I'm not in politics, and I knew what the next, what the video was going to look like, you know, apropos of what Gene's saying. And you know, I want to just get back to Rich's point about sort of this establishment Republican network that is thriving beyond the noise of what Trump is. I think just looking at it from the center, the challenge for Republicans, and I don't think it's Pence, but it's someone else, is like, how do you make the party nice again? I mean, I think that's really a challenge. It's not really on policy anymore. I mean, the anger and the vitriol that has risen, and even if it's only 30 or 35% of the electorate, of the Republican electorate, you know, the damage that will be done by the top of the ticket on immigration, on against women, against whomever, choose it, former Miss Universes, you know, you name it, and to the world, to NATO, to our allies, to a world that is looking at this campaign, you know, with a wary eye. I think that's going to be the challenge. And it may be Pence, and it may be that's what Pence was doing, was just trying to sort of, you know, not make America great again, but make America nice again.
It was a brilliant performance in its way, because Tim Kaine would say these things that Trump has said, and Mike Pence would shake his head like it was beneath the dignity of poor Tim Kaine to bring these things up. And the brilliance of shaking your head is you can't fact check that. Maybe he's just expressing disapproval of the tone of the debate or something. And I take Gene's point, and I agree with it, that Kaine was executing, you know, more of a strategy for the long term, whereas Pence was just trying to win the debate. But at this juncture in the campaign, it was pretty important just for Pence to win the debate, to have a slightly different media narrative, to have something for Republicans to feel good about. And it tells you something about the state of trying to prepare Donald Trump for the next presidential debate, that his team was delighted just because they could at least point to Pence and say to Trump, look, this is how it's done. But it's going to be harder for Trump to pull it off, because Pence can pivot away from things that Trump has said. One, Trump has never shown an ability to do that himself, or a willingness to. And two, it's much harder when you're the actual guy who said them, if your opponent says, look, you won't even defend your own record. An underling, you can kind of skitter away from them. It's going to be much harder for Trump to do that.
I've been amused that Trump has spent much of the week and a half or so since the last debate complaining about the AV situation in the debate room, and that he had a bum mic, as he said. And now he switched a little bit. It wasn't the mic. It's that the soundboard operator was oscillating the volume. And the thing I take away from this, and that I'm sort of flabbergasted that the electorate doesn't take away from it, is that if you're the sort of person who can be thrown off his game by an AV problem, how can you be president of the United States? If you go into a negotiation with the Chinese and you screw it up, are you then going to come out afterward and say, oh, the simultaneous translation was bad, they screwed up the AV equipment, it was bad Chinese AV equipment? I mean, he'll look ridiculous. It seems so contrary to me to the idea of strength, and it also suggests to me that he is not taking lessons from the debate about what he needed to learn and do, instead that just that the problem was the microphone.
You know, Josh, I mean, that bothers me in the way, as like a former competitive tennis player, you know, when one side, you know, complains about the wind or the conditions. But I think that's actually a rather small concern compared to go back to Vladimir Putin. The idea that he feels and publicly defends the idea of complimenting somebody publicly, building them up because they said something nice about you. I mean, you would not have to be a genius as a terrorist group or one of our foreign adversaries to figure out that if you could put taunting criticisms of his masculinity or things like that, that he would not be able to contain himself. And if you can't contain yourself in a campaign, then, you know, I really do worry. I worry about him and those type of actions in a way that I've never worried about every opponent, that I would not have worried about even people I didn't like Ted Cruz. There is something that is a little scary about that. And while maybe Hillary Clinton's line, you know, taunted with a tweet feels like a line, it's not just a line. It's a real concern.
Literally, it doesn't compute for Republicans. I mean, Mike Pence had to come up with an entirely different and opposite policy for a reason. You heard this at the convention as well, where every speaker was talking about how we need to be strong against Russia, apparently completely unaware of what or not willing to account for what Trump has said on Russia because it's so indefensible.
Juliet?
You know, everyone talks about whether Trump can prepare better for Sunday night and what he needs to do. And, you know, just I agree with Gene when I look at him. I get nervous in a way like this doesn't end well. And I'm not quite sure what I mean by that. But I get nervous in a way that this is a person who will blame the microphone, will blame everyone else and not sort of accept defeat gracefully as his other competitors have done. And so I think we're going to see a lot of crazy. And so, you know, this idea that he can do better if only he focused, I don't think there's any proof that he has the capacity to do that. There's not some alternative that we should be waiting for. If only he, you know, read the policy papers and listened to Chris Christie and, you know, was more focused. I think that's like saying, if only I were like 23 and 5'11", like it's just not going to happen.
Obviously, people like myself are very worried about what would happen if Trump won. But it does go to kind of how much he will seek to hurt people's faith in democracy with rigged elections, et cetera, if he loses. And, you know, if you look back over the last several decades, you've had people who've lost elections, Richard Nixon, Al Gore, John Kerry, where, rightly or not, some felt maybe it actually had been contested. And yet, all of them chose to honor the democracy of our country and the peaceful transfer of power. And one does not get the feeling that if Donald Trump loses, that he will honor that tradition. And that will not be a good thing for our democracy.
I increasingly suspect that Trump is going to lose by a wide enough margin that he is not even going to be able to make a credible case to his followers that the whole thing was rigged, but we shall see. I want to get quickly back to something Rich was talking about at the beginning and sort of the return to normal for the Republican Party after what we might now presume will be a Trump loss, which is that this is something that you want and that a lot of people in the establishment want. And what a lot of them are going to mean by that is they're going to want to go back to a much softer position on immigration. What was the position of the Republican establishment, at least inside the Beltway, even as there was a lot of sentiment among Republican voters for immigration restriction? I guess my question for you, Rich, is if the case is the Republican Party should go back to normal and the whole Trump thing was, you know, a weird diversion, how do you make the case that that's not true on immigration, that this is the one thing they need to change?
But that's not my position. And I agree with you that a lot of people, if he loses, especially if he loses badly, and the Senate candidates do better, that's going to be the reflex in the establishment. But I think it's very important to learn from Trump and to take away salvageable lessons and just subtract the personal perniciousness of Trump himself, and not just on immigration. Maybe it's on things that I wouldn't necessarily naturally, I wouldn't have thought about before this election, trade, entitlements, foreign policy. I'm willing to rethink all of those things. I think now the danger to the party is more what you're outlining, is that everyone will want to pretend that this was just a 18-month weird diversion and ignore everything about it.
We're going to take a break. Let us know what you think about the 2020 campaign, because aren't you super excited to be already talking about the next election? You can do that at kcrw.com/LRC. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC. Santa Monica-based public radio station KCRW relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country.
Put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Gene Sperling, who has advised Presidents Clinton and Obama and candidate Hillary Clinton on economic matters. Also with us is Juliette Kayyem, former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security and author of the book Security Mom, which is also the name of her podcast. I should note, Jean will be joining me and several other of our regulars on this show for LRC Live. That's October 20th in downtown Los Angeles. If you want to join us, you can get tickets and information at kcrw.com/LRC Live. So last weekend, the New York Times published 3 pages of state income tax information from Donald Trump's 1995 taxes. They reflected an income of -$916 million. Though Trump has not released any tax information as part of the campaign, this leak means we've now seen snapshots of Trump's taxes from 9 different years over a period from the mid-1970s to the mid-1990s. These documents came from a variety of sources, including filings Trump made with the New Jersey Casino Control Commission back when he was seeking gambling licenses in Atlantic City. When you put all that information together across those 9 various years, we know he had zero or negative income in at least 6 of them over a period from 1978 to 1995. The highest positive income we ever saw him report on an income tax return was just $118,530. That was in 1977. Obviously, those are small numbers for somebody who is really, really rich. In the first presidential debate, when Hillary Clinton accused Trump of not paying income taxes, he said, "That makes me smart." And a lot of Republicans, including Mike Pence, have taken up that line, saying if Trump paid no income tax at all, that just shows he was a savvy businessman. This feels really different from the way we talked about Mitt Romney and the way we've talked about wealthy candidates in politics before. Is this the right line that basically finding whatever way you can to pay as little tax as possible is appropriate, even if you want to be a leader in government?
I don't think he should boast about it. I don't think it makes him a genius. But everyone uses whatever means they legally can to reduce their tax liability. So I don't see a problem with that. And there's not a problem with this specific provision, the net operating loss carry forward. It's just the scale that Trump used was extraordinary. One of the great little details from that New York Times story was the accountant actually, the program he was using could only account for a 7-digit loss. So he had to go in and manually type in the other 2 digits. And another one of these stories, I don't know whether it was in that New York Times story or somewhere else, said that Trump was in such bad financial straits in this period that at one point he was cut down to a monthly stipend of $450,000 a month to live on. But the question is whether it's sketchier in that was this just a paper loss rather than a real loss, and is he using various loopholes and deductions and gimmicks only available to people in the real estate business in order to minimize his income every single year so he never really uses up, so to speak, this loss and has never paid income taxes really at all.
Yeah, and that's what I've been wondering about this, because a lot of the reaction, especially from conservative economic observers, has been to say, hey, there's nothing wrong with net operating losses. If you're in a business that makes money some years and loses it other years, you should be able to offset the losses against the gains. And that's fair enough. But it's just what I've been saying about that we've seen quite a few years of Trump's tax information now. And we've seen this 1 year in which he claims an enormous loss. And we've never seen a tax return from Donald Trump that says, I made $120 million this year and I paid $40 million and taxes on it because I'm a rich guy who pays a lot of taxes. And so when you add it all up together, the evidence is pointing to me to the idea that a lot of this was a paper loss. And it's not just that Donald Trump paid little tax because he went through a really tough time, as Mike Pence said, and he had his ups and downs. It's starting to look like he's a guy who was able to take unfair, even if legal, advantage of the tax code, and that's a thing that would reasonably worry voters. I don't know. Yeah. Gene, what do you make of this, having been involved in making tax policy?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'll do an outrage right here. What's kind of outrageous is, you know, as you say, is there some plausible defense? You know, was this a real loss as opposed to a paper loss? Does he do business with Russia or with China? Does he manipulate his charitable foundation? All of these things. There is one person who could provide the evidence that we know, and that's Donald Trump. So one has to kind of suspect that the answer to these things is not good when you have the evidence to essentially defend yourself. So I think this just is an amazing outrage that he can try to defend himself without putting forward releasing his tax returns that would make all that clear. And I think the other thing that does bother people is the idea, and I don't think this will be good for the Republican Party, and I don't think it's true of most honorable Republicans, but to send the message that if you're part of the lower moderate income paycheck to paycheck type that somehow doesn't have to pay taxes in a year, you're a taker. But if you're a real estate tycoon who lives on millions a month, you're a genius, is not going to go over particularly well.
Juliet, part of what's bothered me about this was Trump basically saying, well, you know, if I send them tax money, they would just waste it anyway. It strikes me as a part of his overall broad efforts to tear down every institution in society and basically say, well, it's all crap, so why bother? It's just part of the very nihilist campaign he's been running.
That's exactly right. I mean, and it begins, and I think you and I had a conversation about this once. You know, remember a long time ago when he went after the fire marshals for deciding, or, you know, he said there'd be more people in this room if the fire marshals would allow more people. You know, this, you know, these poor, you know, county fire marshals who are determining that only 2,000 people could fit in a room. And it was a way, I think, for him to begin a long process of undermining basic bureaucracy. And I mean that as a compliment. You know, the basic rules of how we function as a society. We pay taxes to pay for our teachers and to pay for the military and to pay for all the things that we expect and anticipate from our government. And the fire marshal scenario so long ago just was, I think, exactly that hint of what was to come, that government functioning is bad, there's nothing to defend, and therefore my ability not to pay taxes is not only smart, it's actually teaching the government a lesson. I will say on this, just I know we're talking tax policy, but for most people who have one W-2 coming in and paying taxes, for those of us who have been in government, I mean, just even just the discussion of a $916 million personal loss or business loss is just such a mind-boggling number, I think, for most people, that's why you know, the focus on just the loss rather than whether he was justified in the tax the taxes around it, I think is an important narrative, because it's jaw-dropping.
It's funny, I actually think the loss is in a way so big that people don't quite process how big it is. I mean, obviously $916 million is a ton of money, but this is an absurdly large loss even for a very rich person in a very volatile business. In 1995, the total amount of net operating losses claimed on all individual income tax returns in the whole country was about $49 billion. So Donald Trump was personally responsible for 2% of that in the whole country. So it's outlandish, even if he was a really rich guy who took a really big bath in Atlantic City, the number is still astounding.
Josh, another number for you is you can actually look at the net operating losses taken by people who made over $1 million, and his was 1,500 times larger than the average for people who make over $1 million.
I want to turn quickly to Hurricane Matthew, which in a way is related to this, because Matt Drudge has been tweeting, alleging that there is a conspiracy to overstate the strength of this Category 3, Category 4, depending on the moment, hurricane that's been bearing down on Florida and Georgia, in order to, quote, make an exaggerated point on climate. And the thing I'm not sure how much to worry about is, as trust in institutions gets ground down, and people like Drudge opportunistically point to it, even in events like this, when does that start causing people to not leave their homes when they really ought to in a natural disaster?
I think it's one of the scariest things coming out of the hurricanes. You know, I've been in a career in counterterrorism and disaster management. The hardest thing to do is to get people to evacuate. This is why you're hearing the governors talk in a way that they normally don't talk, which is essentially, evacuate. And if you don't evacuate, we'll see you in a couple days. And it's not just the storm. People don't die directly from hurricanes. They die from the stuff after the hurricanes, the storm surge, the electrical the electrocution and stuff. So when I saw that, knowing the frustration that is happening with FEMA and others and trying to get one of the largest evacuations in Florida and South Carolina, it is beyond dangerous because it undermines people who know a lot better and their desire to, you know, or their desire to save lives. But it also makes people question, you know, things as benign, like, you know, the National Weather Service. Don't go bashing the National Weather Service. Like, you know, can't we have anything that's sacred anymore? So it was very frustrating just from the perspective of looking at hurricane operations.
Well, outside of the question of this specific conspiracy theory, which is obviously completely baseless, it is true that 9 out of 10 storms, the media ends up hyping one way or the other. And it's horrible. I know the media doesn't really mean bad things to happen to people, but you can almost hear the disappointment in their voice, you know, when a storm goes down a couple notches or it goes out to sea, just because there's such incredible hype build up around these things, and everyone gets excited, and it's good for ratings. And that's, I think, that's the more significant reason why people, just beyond just sheer stiff-necked cussedness, are reluctant to heed these warnings.
Well, but then there's the other issue that these storms are inherently unpredictable. So if you know that, if the forecasters know that there's a 30% chance of this storm being really awful to the point where really everybody needed to get out, it's probably correct to order an evacuation then, even though 70% of the time people are going to look at it afterward and say, gee, we could have stayed here.
Right.
So I think you're right that there can be issues of overhype, but I think also there's this problem that you're going to need institutions that people will trust to issue the warnings, even though the warnings sometimes won't pay off. And that, I think, is a hard thing to maintain.
Well, I dealt with this myself. I live in an area of Manhattan. When there's a hurricane, you're supposed to evacuate. And we evacuated the hurricane before Sandy. We went to Connecticut, where actually it hit. and then so when Sandy came around, I really didn't want to leave. We ended up leaving anyway. But, you know, it's a pain in the neck to root yourself up and go someplace else. And if you've felt you've gotten burned once, you're like, why should I go?
Well, we've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Gene Sperling, what's your rant?
Was so proud of my wife, Allison Abner, in 2010 when she came up with the idea for the Rebecca Project to help take down the Craigslist ads that promoted child trafficking. Now that focus has been on Backpage. We just saw their CEO arrested on some pretty terrible charges. I won't comment on his charges, but it is an outrage anytime anyone facilitates knowingly or by turning their head ads that allow or in any way promote child trafficking, because be clear, there is no such thing as child prostitution. It is just child rape, and there needs to be zero tolerance.
Juliet Kayyem.
2016 has been a miserable, violent, sad, crazy year, from Prince dying to Trump rising. So I'm thinking it may just begin to redeem itself when I learn this morning that at the New York Comic Con, a set of Golden Girls action figures are being released. Rose, Dorothy, Blanche, and Sophia are back. And I think 2016 may just be something to smile about now.
If that's all we have, I don't know.
Rich,
I'm desperate.
We've had a head-spinning turn of events in Syria from a few weeks ago when the Obama administration forged a tentative agreement for joint operations in Syria with Russia, to now with John Kerry saying Russia needs to be investigated for war crimes. If your potential peace partner is a war criminal, you're probably doing it wrong.
For my rant, we've reached new depths of our lazy do-nothing Congress. A law that was just signed by President Obama is called the Babies Act. And that stands for Bathrooms Accessible in Every Situation Act. It requires General Services Administration buildings to have baby-changing facilities. That's fine. The problem is that if you spell out Bathrooms Accessible in Every Situation Act, you will find that it does not spell babies. It spells bays. Well, that does it for this week. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Gene Sperling, and Juliet Kayyem. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Katie Burskins is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.